Hello, and welcome to the Tuesday, March 5th, 2024 episode of the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or estate of any performer or composer dead and gone to discuss their music and or recordings. Now, with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guest today is drummer, composer, and educator Jake Richter. Jake Richter is a New York City-based composer, drummer, and educator who aims to create imaginative and engaging music that marries the compositional approach of the Western classical tradition with the fearlessness and deeply honest rhythmic approach of jazz. He maintains an active performance schedule in New York City as a band leader and a sideman, and appears frequently at venues like the 55 Bar, Shapeshifter Lab, Barbès, Bar Bayou, and Room 623. He recently graduated with a master's degree in jazz composition from the Manhattan School of Music, where he studied with Miguel Zenon, Jim McNeely, Kendrick Scott, and Jeff Ballard. Before coming to New York, Richter studied jazz percussion and music composition at Indiana University. While there, he performed with luminaries Bobby McFerrin, Randy Brecker, Marquise Hill, and Walter Smith III. In 2017, he was the recipient of the David N. Baker BMI Jazz Composition Award. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Jake Richter. Hello, Jake.
Hello.
It's really great to talk with you and have you as a guest on my show today. Really been looking forward to having the opportunity to have you on and hear you talk about music and music making.
Thanks so much. I'm super excited to be here.
Well, great. You know, after watching a couple of videos on your website, I think it's very fair to say that your musical interests extend well beyond just straight ahead jazz.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things I remember my high school band director impressed upon me was that music was a painting of sound on a canvas of silence. And I've always hung on to that concept. And I would be very interested to hear you talk about how a composer or a performer thinks in terms of filling time and space, or another way, paints with sound through a time-space continuum.
Totally. Yeah, I love that quote. And it reminds me, it's very, very similar to this John Cage quote that I remember. It's from some interview that I found of his online, where he basically describes his whole musical practice as the exact same thing. He says, like I basically see silence, which in his mind doesn't actually exist, because even in the most silent possible, mm-hmm. environment, there's still like a little bit of ambient sound and little, you know, you can hear your own heartbeat or you can hear whatever, you know. If you think if you're in a silent situation, if you really listen closely, you're probably not in a silent situation. So he sees this ambient sound as like the baseline musical experience. You know, there's always this sort of natural ambient music around you. And then he thinks of his music as I just interrupt that music and then do my own, or I put my own music on top of that ambient music, you know, and then that runs its course and then it's back to the ambient music, which I think is really like poetic and beautiful, you know, that there's really music all around, you know, and music is really just the appreciation, like the human appreciation of sound, you know, is I think is a really interesting way to think about it. So I like that. I really like that quote. In terms of my sort of process, I think just like, you know, just like there are a million ways to paint a picture if we're sticking with that metaphor, I feel like there are just as many ways, you know, obviously to make music or to compose music or perform or any of those things. And one of the ways, one of like the methods that I sort of lean pretty heavily on is thinking about contrast, which has like a really useful, you know, like visual metaphor. If you think about like a painting across space, you know, it's really, you could think about a painting in terms of which elements contrast which other elements where across the space, you know. So that's a lot of how I think about composing is I think about, you know, there's here's maybe how long this piece is going to be, and then here are the aspects of music that I'm going to really kind of play with in terms of contrast throughout the course of that piece. You know, here are the elements of music that I want to try to show the difference between, sort of.
In a sense, this is what's just come to my mind based on what you were saying, is that music that we create as human beings is in effect in counterpoint to the music that is in existence naturally.
Totally. Yeah, and I think a lot of what made John Cage really radical was him kind of pointing that out to people.
You know, and I hadn't, you know, and I've, I think that's fascinating when you think. Now, I've heard it said that the only real silent environment is one that can be artificially created.
Sure, yeah.
And if you were put into an artificially created silent environment, either you would still hear two pitches. One would be from your heartbeat, the other would be your central nervous system.
Yeah, that's exactly that was Cage's quote.
Oh yes. Okay. So I did hear it from Kick because see, I also had the opportunity many, many moons ago to hear a lecture by John Cage.
Wow, incredible.
And
Where was that?
it was we had an international computer music conference when I was in grad school at North Texas. I cannot remember the year, but it was when I think I was and I don't even remember now if I was in my master's or my doctoral program, but I do remember that Cage was one of the guests, and he spoke one afternoon, and I remember going and listening to that. But it's exciting not only to think about that we would hear our heartbeats and our central nervous system, but we also know now too that the universe itself makes sound. And it has color, you know, from the deep space telescopes and radio telescopes and things like that. So, you know, and this idea of human-made music being in counterpoint was something I just now came up with while you were talking. It was a concept that I just happened to grab.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, that's a great way to think about it. And that lens, can really make you appreciate just the sounds around you at any given time too, you know, even more, and hear whatever is around you. Like it's really like sort of a mental attitude thing of like if you are thinking about whatever sounds you're hearing as being music, then they will kind of present themselves to you as music, I think, you know.
Well, you know, and there you go. I mean, it's just a matter of being conscious and being willful, and then being critical. And of course, when I say critical, meaning thinking about what it is you're listening to, and then maybe even engaging in metacognition to the point of, oh, okay, so I hear these sounds. I believe them to be A, and they're created because of B. And, you know, in other words, you're engaging with it on a cognitive and intellectual level. And it's not just background noise.
And one of the things, speaking of like metacognition, that I'm really thinking about a lot these days is these experiences where you're listening to music or making music, and you know, you kind of reach this state where your sense of self almost disappears, you know, or you're so fully immersed in what you're hearing that it feels like your sense of self like kind of escapes your body or mind or something like that, and it brings you to this other place. That's a, you know, I feel like one of those things that we're often chasing as musicians. You know, it goes by a lot of names, but that sense of being totally immersed, swept away. Another good way to put it, I just started reading Henry Threadgill's autobiography recently, but it's called Easily Slip Into Another World. And I think that's such a good way to describe sort of that process, which I'm really, you know, really interested in.
Well, you know, a lot of times now, when I used to teach music preach, I used to try to get my students to think that way. I said, okay, when we listen to Beethoven, let's don't sit here like we're in the 21st century and listening to an old piece of music. Let's take a moment to immerse ourselves into the music, thinking about Beethoven, thinking about his time, thinking about what was going on at the time, you know, in history, and giving some context, and maybe even losing yourself in that. It's like going to a movie that's a historical. I haven't seen it yet, but I can't wait to see the newish movie that's out about Napoleon. Oh, for crying out loud,
Yeah,
can't
I,
think
I
of his
forget who it
name.
is too.
He played the Joker.
Joaquin Phoenix. Joaquin
Yes, thank
Phoenix.
you. Thanks, man. I had a brain fart there. I couldn't think of his
No
name.
worries, no
But
worries.
you know, I love those kinds of period pieces. And I don't know what I've never heard anything about the soundtrack, so I don't know if they're borrowing from that. But knowing that, you know, and inviting people to lose themselves in the present, and I guess maybe even from a psychological or, you know, satisfaction level, maybe that's one of art's purposes, is because it does take us to a different place, you
Definitely.
know.
And almost you know, like counterintuitively does the two opposite things, which is like makes me feel like I'm, you know, like beyond where I am. It like totally takes me into the current moment. I actually heard Pat Metheny say this quote recently, which really stuck with me, which was when he feels like he's improvising on the highest, you know, to the best of his capabilities, he feels simultaneously totally immersed in the musical moment. So like completely present on the most micro level possible is what he says. Completely in the present moment and almost removed from it, you know, almost like this out of body experience or something like that, where he feels like he's, you know, just standing there, like watching himself play the guitar, and like, oh, if there was a guitarist on stage, you know, which happens to be me, what would I want to hear that guitarist play next relative to the things that the people in my band are playing around me? And then he plays that, you know. And so it's this like being totally soaked in, totally in the moment, micro level, and then also like not at all. It's like, you know, you're watching your body do this thing by itself, you know, almost out of body. Yeah, it's amazing.
Well,
But
no, I know. I think I can relate to what you're talking about. I mean, I think we all experience that on certain levels. There's times when when I'm playing, and not necessarily, but I think especially when I'm improvising, that your level of concentration is so high that after a while you feel like it's, well, because it's really, it's your subconscious is taking over, you know, if you allow it to. And I think if, and it's almost like, you know, I know I can see my fingers moving, I know there's sound coming out of my horn, but I haven't got any idea where it's coming from. You know,
Totally.
you're just in the flow and you go with it. And it's something that's really hard to describe to people who are musically lay people, but I think other musicians, when we talk about that, we go, yeah, man, I know what you mean.
Exactly.
You know?
And that's really the thing that I'm out here in New York chasing that experience. Like that's what I want to be doing all the time. And like, you know, that's the thing that gets me excited about music is that sort of immersion, that sort of continuously sustained attention, and that sort of, flow would be one way to describe it. I read that book Flow, or part of that book Flow, a while ago, which was sort of trying to get at, you know, like the psychology of those experiences, but I didn't really think it was that well written. It was kind of maybe making claims outside of its purview. Maybe I'll try to go back to it again. But the word flow is definitely one that like makes perfect sense, you know.
Well, I think Abraham Maslow, who I think is a well-documented psychologist, refers, you know, Maslow would say there's only two peak experiences in life. One of them is music, and the other is sex. So, I mean, you know, music is definitely one of those kinds of experiences that you can't always put into words real well. I mean, in describing the experience, and all, sometimes all you can say is just wow. And I mean that not only as a performer, but also as a listener. We can be so blown away by, you know, what somebody is playing and what we're listening to.
It is really funny thinking about, like, you know, theory, which is something that I'm really passionate about and interested in general, like music theory. But even when you get to music theory at a very high level, you're still totally talking around what music really is, you know? Like any amount of talking about it will never really, really get you to the heart of that experience. You know.
I think
Have
it
you
was,
ever Oh, go ahead, go
well, I
ahead.
was going to say, I think it was Thelonious Monk that said that talking about music is like dancing about architecture. You know, the words and descriptions are inadequate, but I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You
Totally.
were
No,
about
no,
to say
no.
something.
No, that's okay. Yeah, that's the exact same thing as there's this philosopher whose name escapes me, who came out with this sort of like somewhat famous or popular like psychological scenario question called the Mary's Room question. I don't know if you've heard of this.
No, that's new to me.
So it's basically he describes a, you know, theoretical person named Mary who's in a black and white room for her whole life, and she becomes, you know, like she grows up, she's an adult, everything is completely black and white, all the light around her, all, you know, every color she sees will only ever be in black and white. But she gets to read black and white books, and she has a black and white TV screen, so she becomes well educated. And then, you know, she decides to like dedicate herself to the study of color because it's so fascinating to her, and it's sort of like out of her reach, you know. So she learns everything there is to know about, like, you know, the neural mechanisms of the eye, and oh, color is really light that, you know, is vibrating at certain frequencies, and blah blah blah. She learns everything that there is about the physics of color and perception of color. And then she one day leaves her room for the first time ever in her life and sees a bright red apple, you know, sitting on like a table. And the question is, did she learn something new about color through that experience? And, you know, the story is sort of supposed to show, well, obviously, yes, she learned, you know, the experience of color. And it's supposed to open up all these questions about experiential knowledge and how there are some things that are uniquely conveyed through experience, which kind of can't be conveyed through like information, through other means of information. But it's still a hotly debated question, actually.
Well, I mean, I think that's why we can say that as human beings, we have both a cognitive side and we also have an affective side, because emotions are a response to a particular stimulus as well. And so I think those are all just incredibly mind-blowing things to think about. I just started reading a book yesterday, in fact. It's entitled Psych, and it's really how about a history of the mind. I'm really I have just barely scratched the surface of the first chapter, but it just sounds like fascinating about how, like they say, how does this 3-pound hunk of meat, or hunk of fat, create thought and all these other kinds of things that we're probably not aware of because they're all around us. It's like trying to talk to a fish about water. They don't distinguish because it's always been there and it's always around them. So anyway, yeah, I'm looking forward to learning more about that, because as I go along, I get more and more fascinated about how we perceive music, how we think about music, or any of the arts, actually, any of the arts, and what their role is, and getting all out of it that we can, because it's like you, I love immersing myself in music as much as possible. And I knew I was wanting to do that when I retired from full-time teaching. And so that's I'm attempting to do that as well, playing as much as I can, doing a podcast, conducting, all that kind of stuff.
Love it.
So yeah, well, I do love it. And people look at me and say, "But you're supposed to be retired." Well, okay.
Yeah, but this is the most fun thing you can do, You're supposed to
Exactly.
spend your retirement doing the most fun things you can do, and here it
That's
is.
exactly it. I'm gonna keep hitting home with that, because I think that's true. Well,
Totally.
I'd like to talk with you about a specific video that I saw on your website, and it was electronic music and then various manipulations of sounds. And so I think with that, it would seem to me that the artist's palette for sound is seemingly infinite. We just seem to have, and so perhaps with reference to the video on your website of the Penn Sound Collective from last December, would you please talk about choices you may make in terms of seeking new and different sounds? And maybe if you want, specifically refer to what you were doing in that video.
Well, that video was a collaboration between one of my really good friends, Eliana Fishbein, who's a great composer, who I went to the Manhattan School of Music with. We had 1 year of overlap, and we were both getting jazz composition degrees at the time. So I started that in 2018. She started it in 2019. And now she's going to get her doctorate at Penn in composition right now. So for the last maybe year or so, we kind of started this electronic sort of duo project, I guess. And we're sort of trying to think about it much like I would think about any of my other bands, where it's like you have a set of musicians that you bring together with shared interests, and you try to build something that's greater than either of your greater than either of your individual musical contributions. You try to make something greater than the sum of its parts, basically. So we've been working for about a year now on various electronic projects, and it also sort of started because I consider myself pretty well steeped in the jazz tradition at this point, but my interests, like you've noticed, expand beyond that. And I'm trying to, sort of have my electronic music knowledge and my contemporary classical knowledge and my like folkloric drumming knowledge sort of catch up to where I consider my sort of jazz, like modern jazz knowledge to be, So I'm trying to sort of bolster those areas of my musical world. Right now. So Eliana felt similarly, where we both had a lot of interest in electronic music, but it's a really daunting world to get into. So we were sort of like, well, if we start this project together, we can sort of try to, have like regular meetings and have some deadlines and some accountability with each other, where we like, oh yeah, I have to get this project done because I have a meeting in a week, and so I have to try to build this thing to the best that I can, and the amount of time that I have. Those kind of deadlines can be really helpful in learning in general. So we've been working on that, and she invited me to play with her at the Penn Sound Collective concert, which is basically their composers concert at UPenn. The instrument that we were playing, she basically built totally from scratch. So frankly, I don't like totally know all the ins and outs of exactly, she like built this synth by like herself from like, soldering these parts and all this stuff, and like buying all the individual wires separately and putting them together. So really like incredible work. And then I was like very honored that she asked me to sort of come and twist the knobs and dials on the on the concert. But there are many other or not many, but there are other projects that within the context of that duo that sort of lean the other way, where maybe I had the synth and the compositional idea, and then I'll sort of recruit her to play a certain part or to do a certain thing. And we're sort of trying to get that project off the ground right now. So that's the context at least of the Penn concert. But then I forgot the other part of the question.
Well, I was just thinking about the palette of sounds that you could
Right.
choose from. And I just want to interject one thing and then you can
Sure.
correct me if I'm wrong. But it appeared to me from the video that one of you was so perhaps initiating some direction with the sounds, and the other one was then manipulating the sounds. Am I correct in that assumption, or am I observing something else?
I'm not sure. At least we probably didn't think about it that way when we were doing it. I think the way we thought about it was there's sort of a, or at least the way I thought about it is that there's a continuous sound basically that's being produced from this synth, and we each have sort of half of the controls to manipulate it. So I have a certain set of controls that manipulate this continuous sound. She has a certain set of controls, and then it's sort of this like game of ping pong, where I'll change something and then she'll change something in response, and then I'll change something else, and tried to make it sort of a dialogue in that way. So maybe a lot of moments of what you're describing of one person leads, and then you pass it to the next person to lead, and then the next person leads, and then the next person leads, and so on, back and forth.
Yeah,
So
musical ping pong.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
So very,
okay.
very interactive, very, very much in keeping with improvised music, which is both of our sort of roots, and the shared language that we're both very, that we're very comfortable in is the jazz language and improvised music in general. So sort of bringing that affect to the electronic world.
If we reduce this to, say, just purely musical thinking, then
Sure.
it seems like one of you was coming up with an antecedent idea, the other
Sure.
than a consequent idea, and
Yeah.
then maybe those roles would reverse.
Yeah.
So in that in itself, I think is always kind of interesting because I like to think that in a nice, friendly way, and if we get into a, like, say, a either verbal ping pong or
Yeah.
musical ping pong, it's sort of like, all right, let me see what I can get you with this one. And
Right, right,
then the
right.
other person comes back, oh yeah, well, I can counter with this. And
Definitely.
but it's all in on good terms. And I think it makes for good music. I know, like, I've interviewed a number of singer-songwriters out of
Well, not just Nashville, but all around the country. But you
Yeah.
know, and they talk about how many of them have talked about how they enjoy doing co-writes on songs, because they say, yeah, you know, I'll go in with some ideas, and I get together with so and so, and they've got ideas, and so I'll throw out a lyric, and they'll come back. You know, in other words, getting that immediate and instant real-time feedback then lends to you know, a nice cooperative effort that. Yields a really nice piece of art. So that sounds like that's rather interesting. Good.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Well, I think that you know, we've probably already boggled the minds of several of my listeners with this idea of of how we fill musical space, or you know, or as I said, create counterpoint against the continual cantus firmus of the universe.
Exactly. Exactly.
I don't know where that came from. That just popped
that's
into
nice.
My head.
That's the next title. That's the title of your next album, the cantus firmus of the universe.
There
that's,
we go.
There you go.
I better write that down.
Yeah,
before
exactly. Exactly.
Right.
That's incredible.
Well,
yeah.
Anyway, before we scare too many people away,
Okay.
Let's get back to your work in the straight ahead jazz environment,
sure.
Because you certainly do that. And
Sure.
What I'd like you to talk about is experiences kind of where you may have melded straight ahead playing with more avant-garde approaches. Or are those two worlds something you tend to address separately?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I think that, you know, when I think about the musicians, improvisers, composers who I admire the most in the jazz world, they tend not to be that interested in thinking about like the genre names, you know, or in other words, they tend to think about broader concepts about, I mean, kind of about the concepts that we were already talking about, which is like this idea of taking your sound, blending it with the people around you, and making something greater than, you know, than what you all could do individually, you know. And I think that whatever the context is, or whatever the language is, that's kind of my main concern, you know. So regardless of whatever the, you know, if I'm playing ding ding da ding on the ride cymbal, or if I'm, you know, scraping on the cymbals and throwing my brushes around and stuff like that, you know, it's all sort of, ideally it's all in the context of trying to take that sound, match it with others, and then create, you know, these ebbs and flows, and the story of, you know, build something musically, basically with others. So I really try to think about those two worlds like exactly the same, exactly the same way, exactly same approach. The only thing that's different is like the grammar of the content of what I'm playing, but that's almost, you know, it maybe a good analogy would be like, if you're you know, it doesn't matter if you're speaking English or French, you know, those languages, if you're a poet, you just want to make the best poem that you can, which has really nothing to do with whether you're speaking English or French. You know, no one would say that English poetry is better than French poetry, or that French is better than English, or anything like that. It's really just about having an understanding and mastery of the knowledge sufficient so that you can express your creative ideas through that language when you want to, you know? So that's sort of how
I like, I like the term you use, grammar, because like with the English language, you know, there's a lot of different styles of grammar within that, in that over arching label English. But
definitely.
I, you know, I'm with you. You know, I didn't watch the Grammys last week, but
me
I did read. Of course, I read up, because I was curious to see who won what, you know, because it might introduce me to something that I haven't heard yet. And I saw a term that was completely new to me. There's now a category called alternative jazz.
Right.
And I thought, what the heck is that? And so, you know, And you know, it's like it's like we're trying to find words or labels to put the music in boxes.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
But in a sense, jazz, because of its style characteristics, its grammar, if you will, is already avant-garde music to begin with, because sometimes you don't know what's going to be coming next.
Right. Right.
So it's as cutting edge as you can get.
Yeah, exactly. And my favorite Wayne Shorter quote, you know, he says, to me, jazz means I dare you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's like so, so beautiful. You know, that's really, to me, what the heart of it is as well. You know, it's like that pushing and you know, creative, taking creative risks and leaps and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I can remember too. Yeah, I think I can't remember now if it was Herbie Hancock or Wayne Shorter talking about when they were playing with Miles Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And Miles Davis would maybe do something that was a little bit out of what they'd planned to do, but they went ahead and they went with it, and they found that it was a great way. And you've probably experienced this. I know I have too. On the bandstand, there's times when we're playing a tune and somebody, it doesn't go exactly the way we originally rehearsed it, but we don't mind. We just find a way to fix it and go on and make it work. But that's, you know, the other thing I would tell my students, I said, you know, jazz is not just a performing art. It's a performance art, because the art is being created in the moment as you're witnessing it.
Exactly.
And so I guess in that way, you know, when we talk about avant-garde, you know, we think, okay, well, that does conjure an image of certain kinds of music. It's like the story Charlie Haden says when he first met Ornette Coleman, and Coleman says, well, I'm just going to play some stuff and you make up a bass line to go with it.
Right, right.
You know, which is totally turned around from the way jazz usually worked. I guess that's why, why you know, we kind of start thinking about that as being avant-garde. But anyway.
Yeah.
From a just a practical standpoint, because I do have some younger listeners and some maybe aspiring musicians, talk a little bit about how your musical role changes from when you are a sideman to when you are leading a group, and vice versa.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think, you know, I think in a certain way, being a sideman is easier, where I just have to show up and try to make the music sound the best I can. I mean, that's what I'm doing as a leader too, I guess, but it's just like, I'm just trying to, you know, realize someone else's vision, you know? So being a sideman is like, okay, well, I have to try to think about, you know, what the vision or concept is for this song, and then do it in my way, or do it the best way that I, you know, realize it in the best way that I can. Whereas with being a leader, you're also tasked with like coming up with that vision, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have that concept, and then figure out how to communicate it, or maybe even before that part, choose people to play with you who, you know, share that vision already. And then you don't really have to communicate anything. You know, some of my like closest musical collaborators, like the band that'll be on my next album, for example, or my first, you know, first album as a leader is coming out this year, which I'm super excited about. Evan Main, who's an amazing piano player, Connor Evans, who's an amazing guitar player. And, you know, there's some other people, a bunch of other people on the album too, but especially those two who I've played with now for 10 years. Mm-hmm. We really don't have to talk that much about what our shared values in music are, you know, all these things that we're talking about of what we care about and improvising and how much we are, you know, we're trying to be daring. We're trying to make something fresh. We're trying to, you know, we have a shared concept of harmony. We have a shared concept of like collectively improvising a form together, you know, and how important that is. So like many of our, you know, concerts and songs and stuff like that will start, you know, okay, someone's just freely improvising and then someone joins in, and then all of a sudden we're playing one of the songs that we had planned on playing in the concert, and then there's a solo, but maybe the rhythm section breaks down into some, improvised sort of like part making sort of thing, like whatever, maybe, we're taking thematic development and making that into like its own kind of texture or tapestry or something like that while the soloist plays. And then, the outros are exploratory and winding and all those kind of things, that, when I play with those guys, we expect we're not just gonna go, we're counting off the tune and then we play the head and then there's four solos and then we play the head out and it's done. We're expecting to collaborate and not only improvise the notes that we're playing, but improvise decisions about the form and the texture and the orchestration and things like that. So in a certain way, the best experiences as a leader are the ones where it's really like kind of co-led, by these people who we all have a mutual understanding. And then there are other situations that I'm in. Sometimes I'll have more concrete ideas for people, where it's like, this song, I want it this way. We're gonna do it, like make sure it's not too loud, or make sure it's, sparse and ambient for this section, things like that. Occasionally I'll come as a leader like that, but my favorite musical experiences are the ones where it feels totally collective. And similarly, my favorite experiences as a sideman are the ones where it feels totally collective too, like I'm just as much of a leader. So,
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. It's so cool when you're playing with other like-minded musicians and you're so into each other's heads. It's like you can almost guess what the person's going to do before they do it, and or how they're going to respond to something that you do. And I can't even begin to think of how to describe what that feeling is like, but it is it's just very cool. That's all I can say. It's just it's really just a just an exciting experience. Yeah. Well, now speaking as just kind of a day-to-day professional musician, what's one lesson that you may have learned from all the professionals you have encountered in your career that you still carry with you to the present day?
Yeah, that's a huge question. There are just so many, so many things that that I could think of. I was trying to pin down, like, because there's just a million ways that I could go with this answer, and I think one, maybe I'll give a couple, like one specific lesson that you get that I got from like specific teachers, and I'll just kind of go down a little list. So Miguel Zenon, who was my teacher at MSM when I was there, who actually just won a Grammy, speaking of the Grammys, which is super cool for his album. He won the Latin Jazz Grammy for an amazing album called The Art of the Bolero. Anyway, the lesson, a few lessons that I got from him. One of the biggest ones was what he said sort of during his acceptance speech, which is like, really commit to your voice and how you like music to be, and just follow on that path and trust that that will pay off, as opposed to, don't make music that you think people are going to like, or don't make music in such a way where you go, oh, this will probably like win me this competition, for example, or this will probably, make people think that I'm really amazing at the saxophone if I play like this. Really commit to the things that you like about music. Carefully consider what you like about music and follow that path really, really devoutly, So that would be a big lesson that I got from Miguel. I got an amazing like takeaway from my lessons with Kendrick Scott when I was at the Manhattan School of Music, the great drummer. And he had this really incredible, this was my favorite thing that we did during the lessons, which was he had me think about drumming and break drumming down into every component part that I could think of. So like, okay, there's who has your favorite eighth note phrasing on the ride cymbal, and who has your favorite orchestration concept, and then who has your favorite, soloing, and who has your favorite tuning of the drums, and who has your favorite, crash cymbal sound, and who has, whatever it is. So make a giant list of every single thing that you can think of for what is drumming. When you put all these parts together, then this becomes, the total of drumming. So break it into all the parts that you possibly can. Who's your favorite, like in terms of creativity? It could be very concrete things like how do you hold the stick, or how do they look, or how do they, everything, or very abstract things like, who's your, who's your favorite creative drummer, right? So make all these lists and then pick your five or so favorite drummers only as they relate to that category. And this was a super, super eye-opening experience for me because I, got to realize that it's like, okay, well, Roy Haynes, I love the way his swing feel is. I want my ride cymbal phrasing to sound just like Roy Haynes. It's so incredible and so beautiful. But maybe Roy Haynes isn't going to make it into my tuning list or this kind of soloing list or whatever, like same thing with Philly Joe, where it's like, I love the way his ride cymbal sounds. Maybe he's not on my soloing list, or like, Mark Juliana, it's like, oh my God, that sound, the sound that he's getting in this way is so incredible, but then there's this other thing that I don't want to, so
Sure.
looking through that list, it sort of gave me the permission to take some of these historical figures off the pedestal a little bit, instead of just being like, I'm bowing down to Elvin Jones. Everything Elvin Jones did is perfection, and saying, well, what exactly is it that, this drummer does that I want in my playing, and what is it that I don't want in my playing? And so that really changed things for me and was a big step in terms of like finding my voice, getting closer to what I want, in terms of like what I want to sound like, some people talk about being a summation of their influences, but it's also like, you don't want to be influenced by the things that you don't actually like about other people's music. You want to keep those things out of your influences, basically. So that was a really, really inspiring thing, hearing it from him.
It sounds to me like what he was really pushing for was to get you to open your ears and
Sure.
to get rid of any biases that you might already have, either pro or con, and just look at the raw data, so to speak, of what
Sure.
each person is, and then assessing it that assessing that yourself. And
Yeah.
that into itself is an ear training exercise
Totally.
that is valuable, because then you and I'm just saying what I'm saying through my pedagogical lens.
Yeah.
Then you have done you work some muscles, so to speak, in regard to discovering who and what you are as a drummer, because
Exactly.
you've picked up bits and pieces here, you've rejected bits and pieces there. But then Jake Richter is a unique
Exactly. Summation of
summation,
influences. Yeah,
exactly, rather than
exactly.
all of this or all of that, or one or two
Totally.
things. That
Totally.
sounds like that's a very valuable lesson that we all could learn about. I mean, you've really just started from your description, I need to go back now and listen to lots of different trumpet players again and think, because I've never gone through that kind of an exercise,
Sure,
what I
sure.
like, what I don't like, you know, and
Yeah,
so on. And I think there's a
totally.
lot of value in that. And I appreciate you bringing that up, because
Yeah, definitely.
you've stretched my head now. You've stretched my mind, I should
Love
say.
it. I
Oh,
love it.
my head's already swelled. I'm
Yeah.
a trumpet player, but you've broadened my mind. Let's put it that
Good,
way.
good, good, good.
Oh, that's
Yeah.
good. Good.
Yeah.
Well,
Yeah.
if you are going to give a piece of advice to your 20-year-old younger or 20-year younger self, or to another young person aspiring to be a professional, and what it takes to be an effective musician, what key piece of advice would you have given yourself, if you could have 20, 20 years ago, or to other young players who are seeking fame and fortune in the Big Apple playing music?
Fame and fortune. Yeah, I don't have either of those things, so I can't really advise on
No,
how
but
to
that's
get
what we
there.
go, that's
But
what they go seek, though. Yeah.
yeah, exactly. I think maybe I wish someone had told me this about music school in these terms. This is sort of how I've come to view music school, or what I've come to believe about music school, which is definitely not a criticism of it, but is something that maybe I could have considered it for longer and taken advantage of my decision with regards to this thing I'm about to post. So I think that music school is some combination. If you can imagine, like, there's two poles. On the one side you have what is basically like a philosophy degree, and on the other side you have like trade school, just like being an electrician, for example. Both of these degrees, philosophy or let's say electrician trade school, are perfectly valid things for different people to go into, depending upon who you are. With the philosophy degree, you're going into it for more personal enrichment. You're not necessarily expecting, okay, I finish my philosophy degree and then I'm going to go work at the philosophy factory, right? There's no philosophy factory. You're doing it because it helps you grow as a person, and then you take some of those skills that you do it for personal enrichment, you do it to grow as a person, and then you leave school and then you expect to do some other work, whatever that is. And you're not necessarily thinking that this will be, directly how I pay my bills. Maybe you go become a philosophy professor, but that's like a very, small chunk. So this is the one side of music school, right? Where I'm just going to music school. I'm going because I love music, because I want to spend all my time doing it. I'm doing it for personal enrichment. I'm not necessarily expecting to go to music school and see every dollar come back from, exactly music school. But, you finish music school, I'm, totally happy that I did it. I had an amazing experience, and would do it exactly the same way if I had to do it again. And I'm trying to go back to, I'm trying to get a PhD sometime soon in the next few years. So like, that's a perfectly good way to go about it. But you don't expect, to see that money back necessarily exactly through that. You can also do music school the electrician way, which is just being like, I'm going to be, I'm gonna really get my like recording arts stuff together, for example, or I'm really going to get just like some studio type playing together, or I'm really going to get, whatever it is, whatever these professional skills are, I'm going to become someone who people hire to do their scores for notation, or I'm going to become a producer, or I'm going to run a recording studio, or I'm going, these sort of things. There's definitely a way that you can go that route where you're just going, I'm just getting these skills together, and these skills are going to pay the bills, you know, and there is a path towards doing that, but I think some people are drawn to each of these paths, right? Some people are better suited for the personal enrichment, personal expression path, and some people are better suited for the I'm just gonna be a killer on my instrument and go, you know, be a professional like this. And they're not mutually exclusive at all. You know, it's a big Venn diagram with a lot of overlap between these two things. So I would say that if your aspirations are to move to New York for like original avant-garde, you know, modern jazz or improvised music, whatever it is, that you should be thinking about your path more as though you're getting a philosophy degree, where, you know, I'm going to get this degree, I'm coming to New York and doing all this stuff for personal enrichment and, you know, because of the love of what I'm doing and growing that way and all that stuff. And I'm not 100% expecting that to pay off, and I just have like other ways to make money and make my rent and all that kind of stuff. And maybe a, you know, like a super, super small fraction of the people who go that route, just like the philosophy route, you know, will end up like making all of their rent through that, you know, that direction, I would say, like the people who go to become teachers or whatever. But it's like a really small percentage of all philosophy majors are getting their money from philosophies. So same thing with that version of music school. And if you're more interested in the electrician, you know, sort of metaphor route of music school, then that's really great too. That path I don't honestly know as much about. You know, I consider myself to have gone more towards the you know, more towards the philosopher route, and I'm happy to have done it that way. But that would be my advice, is that if you're going that direction, like, you know, even out of my friends who I consider to be like, you know, just some of the most unbelievable artists and musicians like of our generation, you know, like the talent and the depth in New York is just so, so unbelievable. I know, like, I don't know, 2% of all my friends or something are only playing gigs and have no other source of income, you know? I mean, maybe 2%, you know, like it's like almost no one who's just playing gigs, you know? And everybody else is supplementing it in some other way, and we're all perfectly happy to be doing it and really passionate about that still. So that would sort of be my advice, is music school is not one thing. It's two paths, and think about which one of those makes the most sense for you, I would say.
I love the way that you characterize that, because that sounds a lot of the same way that, as you may or may not remember, in Wisconsin, the technical college system is separate and distinct from the liberal arts dimension.
I didn't know that,
And
yeah.
oh, okay. So we had like the University of Wisconsin colleges, which were two-year campuses, but we were in the liberal arts tradition, and we were separate and distinct from like Waukesha County Technical College or Moraine Technical College, or you know, and we, so when we would talk to people about how we distinguish what we do versus what is done in the tech college, we used to say, well, we develop what are called soft skills, critical thinking, problem solving, creative thinking, you know, things like that that can be applicable in any number of fields or endeavors. Whereas a tech college, and this is not spoken in a pejorative sense at all, basically trains you to do a particular job and do it very well. You know, and I think you're absolutely right. In the music world, we have both of those. And there's you know, I run into this all the time. You know, people in my sphere that will not play a gig unless it pays a certain amount. They won't even come out. And then I have more people who are on that philosophical side will say, yeah, sure, We'll go play somewhere for tips or for, whatever the door, because we love the music. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, I appreciate you couching it in those terms, because I think you're right. Those are two different kind of two different paths. And let's face it, I very often make this distinction when I talk about jazz as an art form. I think, jazz is not the big box retailer of the music world. We're not Walmart, Target, and in the music world. We're boutique music. We
I
have a
like that a
very
lot.
specific clientele, and we provide a very specific product to that clientele, but our clientele is out there. It's just sometimes they're a little harder to find, you know.
And that's definitely not to say that, like it's not like people are out here and not making any money from their like philosophy-ish path, we do make money from our gigs and stuff like that. It's just a question of there aren't that many people where that's the only thing they do, It's you piece together a bunch of different stuff,
No,
and try to make it work in the pursuit of this.
Probably a year ago now, I interviewed Andrew Hadro, who's a baritone sax, bass saxophonist in New York. And when I interviewed him from his office at Van Doren, because he works for Van Doren Reeds on the side. And he said to me, he says, "I don't know a single professional musician in New York that doesn't have some kind of side hustle. You know, either teaching lessons or working somewhere in the in the music industry side." I remember another guy I interviewed, he played, but then he also did, like, he would play at Smalls, and he would maybe play upstairs, but downstairs he'd run the lights and the sound for the club, or he was somehow otherwise engaged in helping run the club. So yeah, those are just kind of realities that we have to face. And I consider myself lucky, because at this stage of my life, being retired, I have a pension and Social Security, so I can devote to my philosophical side of playing music that no one else cares about. But
Which is
I'll go out
amazing.
and yeah, but I go out and play it in public anyway,
Totally.
I mean,
And that's, yeah, it's so great.
I have one of the groups I have is a trio, and we purposefully play what I call rare antiques of American music. I mean,
I
it's
love
a
it.
hundred years old or more, right? And
Exactly.
I always yank the audience's chain. I say, "Here we go with another one you've never heard of, by someone you've never heard of."
Totally,
You know what I
totally.
mean?
And
So,
yeah, great. Yeah,
yeah.
exactly.
Well, maybe this leads us into my next question that I want to ask you, and then I'm going to skip over what would be a couple of questions, because I think this next one is relevant to what we're talking about. What's the major challenge of being a musician in the 21st century?
Yeah, I think honestly, I think that it's one of the better times to be a musician out of any time in history, really. And I say that because the accessibility of information is so unbelievably high. Like you really can teach yourself like the jazz language by just going down the right YouTube rabbit holes and stuff like that. And there really are like resources online where if you're, let's say an aspiring or passionate high school student, who has an instrument, you can go and find, like a million videos of like, oh, here's this person's trumpet warm up, and here's like one of the best trumpet players in history talking about, how they think about art, and then here's a modern trumpet player talking about embouchure in a 45-minute podcast and stuff like that. So the resources are extraordinary that are available. I think that can be slightly double-edged because you have to know what you're looking for. So like it is very useful to have a guide in addition to that, like someone who says like, hey, you should really listen to these five drummers who you might not have heard of in the sea of a million drummers who are online and that sort of thing. So I think there are some things that are uniquely good for us right now in the 21st century, and that's one of them is the fact that the information is so available. I think compared to maybe 30 years ago, it's not really possible to like sell your music and have that be your main, like all of your income, from like CD sales or album sales, things like that, that used to be, that used to be a big chunk of like an artist's income. Because the streaming really kind of, put the kibosh on that whole thing. So that part isn't as good, but in terms of like, like maybe there are some financial aspects that are a little trickier, but part of that has to do with the fact that there are so many people like in, in New York and everywhere who are just operating at this insanely high level, like unbelievably masterful instrumentalists, and there are so many of them around. And this is because of like the amazing information, and like amazing access to art that we have. So that would be my answer.
I think, and you're right. Technology is a double-edged sword. There's no doubt about it. I mean, having lived my life in both a pre and post internet kind of world, it's like a lot of stuff now that anybody can access really easily. When I was younger, you had to go to a clinic or something being put on somewhere, or maybe you picked it up when you went to music school. But now anybody, it's like when you were talking about videos, I know, I think it's Vic Firth has a whole series on the history of the drum set. And so when I've gotten a new drummer for my early jazz group that I have, I said, I'll just send them links to this. I said, okay, notice how the style of drumming much different at the turn of the century and before 1930, because that's the kind of music that we're playing. And I said, so you could probably just leave your hi-hat at home because it really wasn't something that existed
Yeah, they didn't
before
have it. Yeah,
1930, and make more of an emphasis on the snare drum, like because this all came out of like brass bands, marching bands, this sort of thing. And you're right about all those other resources. I mean, transcriptions of solos and transcriptions of arrangements
Yeah,
that
all the
some,
theory stuff,
oh, it's just there. And so it really is thickening the texture of people who are coming at you with a much more or a more well-grounded, sort of understanding about the music and so forth. So yeah, I think that idea of about technology and that double-edged sword, I've heard that from a lot of people in the business. Well, let's switch gears just a little bit. Kind of going back to your maybe that we'll call this your origin story. Who turned the light on for you? What turned you on to music?
Yeah, great question. I think like many of my friends, many of the people who I know who are out here trying to do this, and honestly, even in this Threadgill autobiography, I'm seeing his, parallel to it, where he describes all these like early childhood experiences, like way before I had any, like music was all around me. My parents listened to music all the time in the house, really good, my, very diverse tastes in music, and a lot of like, alternative, whatever, to use that word again, a lot of off the beaten path music, that was on around all the time. But, my mom tells this story of like taking me to some like early childhood development thing for like toddlers, where it was like you go in and there's a bunch of art, there's like places to draw and there's places to like, a little jungle gym to climb around on, and then there's like little instruments. And I would just, even when I was like 2 years old, I would just beeline for the instruments, and I would be there the entire time, and I would not leave the instruments until we left the, until we left to go home. Or like I would go visit my aunt's house, who had a real piano, and I would just play it the whole time I was there, just like tinkling around, like no idea what I was doing, but just messing around on it. Or like many versions of that all throughout my childhood. So I think who turned the light on for music for me, I really had it on, like it was always on, for forever, from early childhood. And then there were people who really majorly helped me progress throughout my childhood. So a few of the beginning, I took some piano and guitar lessons, but didn't really like the teachers that much when I was younger, because they didn't really teach me how anything works. They were just sort of teaching me like okay, play this. This is correct. This is how you play this song. But I had no idea about like any how anything worked. But then the people who really got it going for me were the Keens, Randy Keene and Kathy Keene, Mrs. Keene, who Mrs. Keene was my middle school band director, and she was incredible. And then her husband, Dr. Randy Keene. Do you know Randy?
The names sound familiar, but I
Sure,
can't.
sure.
I'm not sure that I know knew them.
Yeah. So he's like this unbelievable percussionist, like got his doctorate from Miami, in classical percussion, and was a serious jazz player too, played with Brian Lynch and a bunch of people like that. And so I started taking private lessons with him, and then being involved in Kettle Moraine's really great band program. So they were some really important people early on. And then Pete Lang was really like a super, super important person early on. Like can't express enough how much he helped me in searching, in my musical journey.
Well, that's really great. It sounds like you already had the flame burning, and then you had some people that helped add fuel to the fire.
Yeah, totally.
Well,
Totally.
that's awesome. And I think
Yeah.
that having, great, there is no substitute for having great teachers. I know my high school band director just passed away last year, and all I could for a couple of days was think about all the ways in which his being my teacher kind of guided me towards loving music even more than I did.
Totally.
I think
Totally.
that's very much
Yeah.
okay. Well, as we're kind of getting down towards the end, number one,
Sure.
I don't want to let you go without you telling us more about this new album you've got coming out,
Sure,
or
yeah.
what I should say is what you can tell us, because I know there's some things that you're probably not
No,
allowed to
yeah.
divulge, but.
Yeah, I'm super, super excited about it. The album's called Listen to the Birds. It'll be out. Let me look up the exact dates, actually. I forget, but I have my email right here. It's going to be released on Endectomorph Records, which is a great record label based in Brooklyn here, which is run by the incredible saxophonist Kevin Sun. And it's going to be out, the first single's coming out, and what is it, May 24th, January? Yeah, May 24th. And then the full album will be out September 20th. So there's some singles getting released sort of on streaming. And then, yeah, September 20th, the full thing will be out. And I'll probably try to do a Midwest tour around that time too, to, because I've taken the band that plays on that album, or half, there's two bands that play on the album, but the one band that plays on half of it, I've taken on two tours through the Midwest over the past couple of years, and I think we'll plan on doing the third for this album release. So yeah,
Well, are you planning to come to the Milwaukee area?
definitely,
Oh,
definitely. And
good.
I will let you know. I'll
Please
definitely
do.
let you know.
Please
yeah
do. I want to make
yeah
sure I can be there if
yeah awesome.
hopefully everything will match up, and
Yeah,
that's great. Well,
totally.
that's really great. And is this going to be an album of all original compositions of yours?
Yep, all my
Okay.
original music. And the first band features two of the people who I mentioned earlier, Evan Main and Connor Evans on piano and guitar, respectively, with Dan Montgomery, and so on bass, who and that's the band that we took on the or that I took on the first two tours, and we sort of got our start playing at the now defunct 55 Bar in New
Oh
York, which
yeah,
was like
sure.
a really special place to get that band sort of off the ground. We had a like almost monthly, or I had like a monthly-ish thing right after the pandemic, kind of up until they closed, which was really a special place, special place to play, and I miss that gig a lot. But so we sort of started out playing together there, and then I it really clicked, and then I brought that band on the road, that specific band with Dan on bass,
Okay.
and then the other half features some like really incredible Brooklyn-based musicians. Brandon Choi, who I know you've interviewed in the past, Netta Renan, who is a really, really great tenor saxophone player, Dobbin Ryu on piano, and Walter Stinson on bass. And that
Oh,
second
wonderful.
band is more kind of like a focus on my compositions. So it's like a band that's the music is a little bit more tightly, reined in, arranged, and it's more about the writing and these longer form ideas that I have for writing. And then the quartet is really about stretching and exploring and improvised exploration. So
Very cool.
yeah.
So the tour that you're planning, are you going to do that like sometime this summer, or are you going to wait till after the release of the album in support of the album?
I think we're going to shoot for it right around when the album releases.
Okay.
I think I'm
All
going to
right.
try to do it like when I'm out there,
Okay.
basically. Yeah.
All right. So sometime
Yeah.
in the fall, we'll be looking for you.
Good,
I
good,
think
good, good.
that's going to be great. Hey, well, if
Yeah.
I could magically, beam myself to New York in the next few
Yeah.
weeks, where are some typical or regular places I might be able to hear you play?
Yeah, I'm playing at Shapeshifter Lab in a couple weeks, which is a really great like club for original music. I'm playing a big band gig there, which is going to be super fun. And then as far as just the good clubs, which I'm sometimes at and sometimes I won't be there, obviously, and then you'll hear another great band. Bar Bez is a really amazing venue in Brooklyn. Bar Bayou is a really great venue in Brooklyn as well, in Flatbush. And then I would say Ornithology, there's always really great music happening. So those
Wow.
would be the three clubs that I would recommend most immediately for hearing either me or some other really talented young people out
Is
there.
Ornithology, is that in Brooklyn as well?
It is, yep.
Wow,
Yeah.
what is going on with
That's
Brooklyn? I've been hearing so
what
much. Well, I've interviewed,
Yeah.
I don't know how many people I've interviewed that are in, living in Brooklyn and working in
Yeah.
Brooklyn, and there seems
Yeah.
to be this I'm getting this impression, kind of this groundswell of activity in Brooklyn.
Yeah, big time. I mean, it just speaks to the fact that Manhattan is like totally unaffordable to live in now,
Okay. Yeah.
Either you can live way uptown, like in Washington Heights or Harlem, which is more associated with like a straight ahead scene, because the people who go to Juilliard or the Manhattan School of Music tend to live up there. That's where I lived when I was going to the Manhattan School of Music 2018, 19. And then that's sort of it's almost like two separate communities now, where there's the straight ahead scene up there. There's a lot of overlap between them, but it's really it takes like an hour to get between the two. So it's almost like as different as the Milwaukee scene and the Chicago scene, for
Wow.
example,
Yeah.
or something like
Yeah.
that,
Yeah.
where
Yeah.
so anyway, there's sort of the uptown thing, and then almost everyone who doesn't live uptown lives in Brooklyn, in some of the more like affordable neighborhoods in Brooklyn. So yeah. And then,
Well,
there's plenty of clubs, but even the clubs, in Manhattan can't really afford to stay open like they could. We've lost a lot of venues in Manhattan over the past few years. So now they're sort of popping up in Brooklyn a little more.
Well, that's interesting to know because It just seems to me like I'm taught all the, you know, I'm talking to all these different people, and they're
Yeah.
you know, in Brooklyn, and I think, well, that's cool. All
Yeah,
right. Well,
totally.
good. Well,
Yeah.
you know, Jake, when I do an interview, I try to be as thorough as possible. And yet I know I'm not perfect. And so I'd like my last question to ask you, is there anything else you'd like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
Oh gosh, I don't think so. I think we covered a lot of really great ground today.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think personally we have swung very well from the pendulum of philosophical to,
yes,
you know, what,
exactly,
you know, the nuts and bolts thing and everything in between.
Exactly.
I appreciate about our discussion is that I think we've covered a lot of ground, a lot of things that should be mentally stimulating for my listeners. And,
yeah.
So I appreciate that. And Jake, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with me today. And I want to wish you all the best with what I'm sure is going to be a continued successful musical future.
Thank you. And likewise, and I'll see you when I'm in Wisconsin next.
Hey, I'll be looking for you in September-ish or
Perfect.
October or whenever you get
yeah,
here.
Yeah, whenever it is. Perfect.
All right. You take care.
Perfect. All right. Thanks so much.
My discovery composer of the week is Ivan Trevino, a Mexican-American composer, percussionist, writer, and arts advocate. Born in 1983, Trevino has shared his music with audiences around the world, from Asia to South America to Madison Square Garden in New York City. As a composer and songwriter, Ivan's music has been performed on 5 continents in over 25 countries. He is a multi-award-winning recipient of the Percussive Arts Society's International Composition Contest and has over 70 compositions and songs to his name. Most recently, he was the featured composer on American Public Media's Performance Today. An active educator, Ivan currently serves as lecturer in percussion at the University of Texas at Austin. He is also co-director of the Eastman Percussion Festival, a biennial summer festival hosted by Eastman School of Music. He is an artist and clinician for Innovative Percussion, Black Swamp Percussion, Zildjian Cymbals, Evans Drumheads, Pearl, Adams, Meinl, and Beetle Percussion. Ivan is also well known for his work as a drummer with Break of Reality, an international touring cello rock quartet. Break of Reality has released 5 studio albums and has been featured on PBS, Huffington Post, Yahoo Music, and is on regular rotation on National Public Radio. Ivan's work spans various media, including storytelling, poetry, and film scoring. His collection of online writings are regularly circulated throughout the arts community, including My Pretend Music School, a blog post that has sparked debate about music school curriculum and has become required reading for collegiate courses around the United States. Ivan currently lives in Austin, Texas, with his wife, Amanda, and their children. The All Music Guide currently lists 3 recordings of Trevino's chamber music for percussion or wind quintet with percussion. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube performance of Trevino's Pajarito for Percussion Ensemble, performed by the University of Texas Austin Percussion Ensemble with Ivan Trevino. That wraps episode number 179. My show notes, along with links to artists' websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artists' performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, the musical universe of Professor Hurst. Next week, I'll be interviewing New York-based jazz bassist Dave Barron. Other upcoming interviews include New York-based pianist, composer, and arranger Kaylee O'Doherty, Melbourne, Australia-based jazz saxophonist Anton DeLecca, Minneapolis-based jazz singer Leslie Vincent, and New York City-based singer Hannah Gill. So don't touch that dial. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurstc@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog signing off from the musical universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.